for the week of June 21st, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 9, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Amsterdam, Holland, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
Now, as I just mentioned, I'm still on the road. I'm not in the studio using our regular recording equipment, which explains why the podcast may not sound the way it usually does. However, just to show you what a worldly podcast we are, Karen Woodward is in Los Angeles, and joining us from New York is New York Daily News and Huffington Post writer Michael Giltz. Actually, Michael is becoming somewhat of a regular. He was with us just a few episodes ago to discuss the Tonys. And actually, Michael, I should tell you that I was in New York a couple weeks ago for a high school reunion and wound up seeing some of those shows.
Well, what did you see?
I wound up seeing one of the three episodes or segments of...
The Norman Conquest.
The Norman Conquest, thank you. I can't believe I forgot it because it was so good.
It's the best six-hour comedy you've ever seen.
I don't understand how the other two segments could compare to the one I saw, because I walked out thinking, well, I saw the best one because it explained everything.
Which one was it? Were you in the garden or the dining room or the living room?
Table manners, which is the dining room.
That's right. To explain to people, this is a six-hour comedy shown in three parts. It all takes over the place of one weekend. And if you see one play, you watch everything that happens in the garden during that weekend. So other stuff is happening. And then if you go the next night, you can see what happens in the dining room. And you go the next night, you see what happens in the living room. And it's all the same, you know, six people. And you know some of the things that are going on in the other areas. And it's incredibly elegant how it's put together. And you can see them in any order, which doesn't seem possible, but it's true. And they're all very satisfying on their own, and yet they all click together. And it's a very clever show with a terrific ensemble cast.
Now, do you have to pay full price for each one?
You get a discount. If you see all three plays, it's like $180, I think, or something. I'm not sure what the actual package deal is, but a Broadway show is like $110. If you go see one show, you got to pay, you know, a standard show. You're seeing a 2.5-hour play, you know, with a full cast. You're not being cheated because you can see a show, and as he says, it stands on its own. And it's well worth seeing if you can just see one or two or all three. But you certainly don't get a discount just because you're seeing a third of it, because they're all full-length plays.
It certainly made me want to see the other two.
Yeah. No, it's a very fun show.
I also saw Ruined, which you recommended.
Great.
Yeah, Ruined.
How was it?
Ruined, it's a very good play, very well written, but it is a hard subject. And it's about a Congolese brothel, basically. And the women that are... That make up the brothel, at least two or three of them, and it's a very well-acted and well-written play. It's just a very hard subject about basically women who are enslaved into becoming prostitutes.
Well, it did win the Pulitzer Prize, deservedly so, and for me, I don't find any show hard if it's well done. I'd rather see a good show about the Holocaust than a bad show about, you know, teenagers in love.
I'm going to disagree with you on that, but...
Just because I wanted to, like, you know, end the weekend on a real high and upbeat note, and I saw these two on the same day, Ruined, and then at night I went to see Next to Normal, the musical about depression and psychotherapy. It was, which, the first half I thought was phenomenal. I couldn't believe somebody had made a musical about taking Prozac and a family that was dysfunctional and the mother was going nuts, and it was really great. The second half, I thought it was a little weaker.
What fell apart for you? When you figured out the trick in the show, or what was it?
I don't know what it is that didn't work out for me. I just maybe I was tired. Maybe I don't know. I mean, I guess the music wasn't as good.
Here's my question: if this is a musical about depressions, right? So, like, I mean, what kind of songs are we talking about here? It's clearly not song and dance numbers, right?
It's a Sondheim type show with sort of sung through, you know, not catchy numbers. It's much more about, you know, thoughts and developing ideas. So it's not where you come snapping the tunes. You're you're getting involved in the characters in the show.
It's like Rent in a way.
Yeah.
Although Rent had some snappy tunes,
and Rent's got a good soundtrack.
most people, the big draw of the show was Alice Ripley, who won the Tony for Best Actress, who was terrific as the mom having the mental breakdown, and the young actor J. Robert Spencer, who plays her son, who has a really fun dramatic role in the show.
Yeah, and they were great. I mean, Alice Ripley was phenomenal in that role. I can't imagine seeing it with anybody else.
Yeah, no, neither can I.
Well, I know. Well, thank you, Michael, for recommending some of those plays and musicals to us and to me, especially since I just saw three of them.
We're glad to do it, and hopefully some other people heard our talk and went to see one of the shows, and they could let us know about it by calling or emailing us.
That's right. I should say right up front, since it seems some people don't make it to the end of our long-winded podcast, that you can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And you can call us toll-free, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. So we will be reading some of the emails on the podcast as well. We'll be reviewing all the voicemails each week and playing a few of them on the podcast and responding. So feel free to get in touch. This week, however, we have a lot to talk about, including Sean Penn taking a year off. And Sam Mendes not taking a year off. He's actually got a 2-year deal with Focus. We'll talk about that. Looks like Steven Soderbergh is going to have to take some time off since Sony just scrapped his film. Public Enemies, Michael Mann's next movie, is getting a few early reviews. And The Weinstein Company seems to be in a bit of trouble. Karen's going to tell us all about Al Roker and some Heidi...
Spidey,
who knows what it... she'll explain it. Also, we're going to talk about David Letterman and Sarah Palin, and we'll have a little inside baseball at the end about Paramount Pictures and its leadership and what's going on there. But for now, why don't we jump right in with the... Let's talk box office.
Box office.
Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds, The Proposal, won the weekend. It made...
Yay!
Even though Karen that didn't go see the film.
Yeah, despite the fact that my $12 didn't add to their $31 million take, yeah. I'm going to see it next weekend.
$34.1 million. It's the largest take for Sandra Bullock ever.
It's almost double. She's almost consistently made $9, $10, $14, $15, $16 million opening weekend on virtually every movie she's made. She's remarkably consistent. And this movie has doubled her best take. It must be Ryan Reynolds, I guess.
I was just going to say, why is Ryan Reynolds not getting anything for this? And everyone considers it a Sandra Bullock movie. Ryan Reynolds, anyone ever heard of him?
No, that's probably why it's considered a Sandra Bullock movie.
He hasn't made it past the mom test yet. I don't get it. He's like such the type of actor that like my mom would just love. He should be a star.
Yeah, certainly yeah. This movie is going to help turn him into a star.
I think he is a star.
Okay.
He was in X-Men Origins Wolverine earlier this year, which had a big opening, not because of him, but he's been in a string of movies that have done, you know, pretty solid box office ever since.
But that's what's so weird. That's why it's so weird that he doesn't pass the mom test. My mom doesn't know who Ryan Reynolds is, but she certainly knows who Sandy Bullock is.
He definitely skews a little younger because of the Van Wilder movies and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. I guess that people in their 20s definitely know who he is, right?
Yeah.
Two movies that have done quite well over the last couple of weeks, The Hangover and Up, came in second and third. The Hangover only dropped off 18.1%, making $26.8 million this weekend. Its total gross to date is $152.9 million. Now, we should say these are only North American grosses, so for those listening outside of North America, we should figure out how to get some international grosses.
Have either one of you guys seen The Hangover?
Yes, I have. It's actually very funny in a raunchy kind of way.
See, it's getting all this press and, you know, getting all these good reviews. I have as yet to meet somebody who thinks it's a good movie.
Oh, it's
I
not.
Haven't seen it, so I don't know.
It's a funny movie. It's a throwaway funny movie.
I love that Bradley Cooper. Mm-hmm.
Oh, he's very good in it, actually.
Yummy.
Oh, my God.
Single. Brad, email us.
Single.
Sorry.
Isn't he married?
No, he was married to Jennifer Esposito for like a minute.
You're keeping tabs.
I know these things.
Up came in third. It made $21.3 million. Its gross to date in North America is $224.1 million, and it has dropped a steady 30% week over week each week, which is really good for a film these days. Year One opened this week to $20.2 million. Year One is the comedy, the BC comedy with Michael Cera and Jack Black.
Jack Black. It looks really funny. I thought that the, and I usually, I'm not a huge fan of either one of them, but I thought that the previews looked hysterical.
Have you
really
seen this, Mike?
No, I haven't, but I have friends who've seen it, and they think the reviews are being too kind. They think it's just an awful film. But the movie pretty famously had god-awful previews and trailers at the Super Bowl. During the Super Bowl, they aired an ad for this movie that was so remarkably unfunny that everybody thought they had poisoned the movie completely. So this is a little bit of a recovery for the movie. As it got closer to air date, they started to air some ads that weren't so horrifically unfunny. And now the movie's opened up to where a Jack Black film usually does. Though arguably the bigger star at this point is Michael Cera.
It's Michael Cera. Yeah.
Yeah. I find him delightful. Did either of you see him on Letterman a night or two ago?
I did not.
No, but I can only imagine. I think he's hysterical. I'm not a huge fan per se, but I do think he's pretty funny.
Yeah, he's sort of very naturally funny. He's very geeky. He was on Letterman. He looked about 12 years old, and he was just very, very droll, very funny. And he's sort of an old classic Hollywood character actor. He plays sort of the same guy in every movie. I don't think he's going to suddenly dive into a dramatic role or play Shakespeare, but
did he say he wants to stop acting?
Oh, did he? I didn't hear that.
Yeah, no, this was news, like, I don't know, like 3 or 4 months ago. And I was like, what are you going to do, buddy? I think he wants to write
and direct.
Well, another movie that he's going to get a lot of press for is Paper Hearts, which is that Sundance film that he's in that's kind of a mock documentary, pseudo-documentary. It's getting some good buzz. I saw it. I thought it was okay. It got mixed reviews.
And Up, of course, is turning into, it's on pace with Finding Nemo to be one of Pixar's second biggest hit of all time, if not biggest. I think it'll definitely gross $300 million. It's already at $225, and it's not breaking a sweat yet. I couldn't be happier.
It just goes to show you what happens when you make a film that both kids and 85-year-olds can enjoy.
And everyone in between except Karen.
Yes.
Except me. I'm not going to see it. I just don't want to see a cartoon. But a little fat kid and an old guy.
Another film you're not going to see, Karen, is The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, which came in fifth, earning $11.3 million. It's made $43.3 million to date. It fell off.
Everybody I know who's seen it says it's awesome. I must stand corrected. I just can't stand Denzel or John Travolta. I cannot stand them. I know that I'm wrong, but
Off 51.7%. That's remarkable.
Well, it's, you know, there was no need to remake it. It's a very, very fun movie from the 70s starring Walter Matthau, and rent the original.
Well, you mentioned that Michael Cera wanted to take some time off, and Karen, you highlighted a story this week from Deadline Hollywood that Sean Penn seems to be taking some time off, about a year.
Yeah.
What's he going to do?
Totally, Nicky Fink. From what Nikki Fink reports, she's going to take time to do work on his marriage, which...
Wait, she's going to take time to do work on his marriage?
No, he's taking time off to work on his marriage, which if anyone, you know, is like me and follows all this stuff, he and Robin Wright Penn, his wife of like, I don't know, 20 years, have been like on and off for as long as they've been together, so...
It's a very volatile relationship.
Yeah, and they just filed for divorce and then just pulled that again, and... So it's taking like a year off. Not that we're going to miss him. I mean, he's in what? A movie every 2 or 3 years anyway?
Well, he did just win the Oscar for Best Actor. So I guess it is.
So? Still doesn't have anything to do with the fact that he's, you know, he's not exactly, you know, burning up the box office all the time. But it does affect the Three Stooges.
And Cartel. So MGM was going to make the Three Stooges. Penn was going to star. Universal was going to make Cartel. I don't know what Cartel was about, but... They're moving on without him.
He also has he has at least one movie in the can. He has The Tree of Life, the next Terrence Malick film. Terrence Malick is a great director, of course, who did Badlands and Days of Heaven The Thin Red Line and The New World. But whenever someone says, "Oh, I'm taking a year off," I always think It's just an excuse to get out of a particular project. I don't know about his private life, and I don't, you know, it's none of my business. I don't care. But, you know, if he took a year off, we wouldn't notice. Like Karen says, people usually have enough projects in the works, and it only takes 3 months to make a movie when you're an actor. So why even bother telling us, except he wanted to get out of projects and needed an excuse?
I love that. I didn't think about that. What movie do you think he was trying to get out of?
Maybe Three Stooges.
I'm going to say Three Stooges.
I don't know why he was ever casting.
Nobody would notice. Nobody would notice if he dropped out of Cartel, but the three, because I don't even know what it is either, and it's not listed on his IMDb. But Three Stooges is a big high profile one, and maybe he just felt like, you know what, I don't need this. I got an Oscar. My marriage is a little rocky, and we're going to settle down and just put that to the side.
Well, somebody who did want to take some time off is Steven Soderbergh, and he was supposed to start shooting the adaptation of Michael Lewis's 2003 book on baseball, Moneyball, which is about the Oakland A's general manager Billy Bean and how he put together that successful team based solely on statistics and not on star power. Or
what the book does is Moneyball, the idea is that you get rid of the whole gut feeling and superstar aura, and you just look at the statistics, and that's how you determine who's a good player, and you get really involved in stats, and you get a lot more stats than the other guy. More information is more power. You don't get caught up in the glamour of getting a big name when you can see that you can get another guy for a tenth of the price who has stats that measure up just about the same. And so, it has worked for the Oakland A's and other teams. You know, when you're smart, now other teams are catching up and using statistics really well, just like they have. So you sort of lose that edge. You have to keep fighting to keep your edge. But it's all about the stats and all about real skill and not getting caught up in glamour and big names.
But why are they scrapping the movie?
Well, apparently Amy Pascal, the head of Sony, and this was a Sony film, read the script over last weekend, or she read the script recently, I don't know. She made the decision Friday after reading the final draft, according to Variety. And she decided that the script she read was very different from the script that had been greenlit, so she scrapped the movie. Now, Brad Pitt was supposed to star in this film.
Why did something like this come down to the very last minute? I mean, if it was supposed to shoot on Monday, 22nd, why is Amy Pascal only now getting around to reading the final draft?
I don't know. That does seem very fishy.
I think this draft showed up like in the last week or two. The implications that they've had, it's not like they've had the final draft for 6 months. The idea is that they dramatically reworked the film in the last few days as far as what they were going to do, and it's all
but
malarkey.
Didn't she know that they were going to do that?
Of course. It's like they're artists. I don't think they suddenly said, by the way, we're going to have everybody mime their roles. I mean, how dramatically different could it be? It's a bizarro film from the get-go. It's you have real athletes playing themselves or characters based on them. You have real documentary interviews with baseball players and managers and people mixed in with a fictional storyline. It's a very strange, odd movie. And I think she finally said, oh, my God, why are we spending $50 million on this movie? It's not a big blockbuster, and it's not an art film. It's that horrible middle area that Hollywood hates where it costs a decent amount of money, but it's so weird you could end up making $10 on it. And I think she finally realized it's not necessarily a commercial film. Soderbergh has a terrible track record for anything other than, you know, the Ocean's movies. And she suddenly realized she was making a movie that almost certainly wouldn't make its money back.
Steve Zalian wrote the script, and he's a pretty good writer. I mean, he's a darn good writer.
It might be a really well-written script. It doesn't No, I agree with Michael. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a good movie, a big movie.
Yeah, Steve Zalian wrote Schindler's List, for those who don't know who he is.
Well, it could be a great movie, but it wouldn't necessarily make its money back. It's a very odd film when you find out there are real-world interviews with people, like documentary footage, mixed in with baseball players playing roles, mixed in with Dimitri Martin as, you know, a geeky nerd guy. It's a very, you know, it's a weird little duck. And she should have known that in advance, you know.
Well, that's, I guess, what my issue is that she should never have waited this long to, whether it she really did wait this long to read it or whether that's just an excuse. It's like, okay. Come on, really? It just seems irresponsible.
Into the pre-production of it.
Right, and she should have been aware of what was going on.
And $50 million isn't that much money these days. I mean, $80 million is a romantic comedy. Yeah, so to me it's an okay gamble, you know. If you get an Oscar-worthy movie for $50 million, you know, all right, you know, you can live with it. It's not going to make a lot of money overseas, you assume, because it's baseball. So you just have to say, all right, you made it for $50 million with Brad Pitt, and it could be an award-worthy film. What the heck? I know you were in Sperling. I know you were in New York seeing some plays. Did you happen to catch any of the Sam Mendes shows that were playing there just a few weeks or months ago? They're now in London. He has two shows. He has Chekhov and Shakespeare. And the Shakespeare, Winter's Tale, is one of the best productions I've ever seen. And isn't there some new news about Sam Mendes in the Hollywood world?
Well, he just signed a two-picture deal with Focus Features. And Focus Features, of course, is the studio behind his latest film, Away We Go, which is a kind of an independent film for him.
Of course, he's best known for American Beauty.
I thought he was best known for being married to Kate Winslet.
I'd say he was best known for American Beauty.
Yes.
Right. Which
he's
is
a filmmaker.
A movie that I don't think anybody likes.
Yeah, it's a terrible movie.
Yeah. American Beauty?
My God, yeah, I'm so glad we agree on that.
Yeah, it's one of the really bad Oscar winners. You know, one of those movies that, you know, it won, and then everybody goes, "Yeah, you know what? Actually, it's not that good."
Yeah.
Why did you not like American Beauty, Michael?
I didn't like it from the get-go. I haven't had second thoughts about it. I thought there was some good acting in it, but the whole film was this, you know, look at the suburbs, and oh my gosh, the suburbs, everyone seems happy on the surface, but actually it's broiling with resentment and hate underneath, and it just was very tired. And when you look at it now, it's so overwrought, all the stuff with the neighbors and the catatonic wife, and then the husband who turns out to be perhaps closeted gay. It's just all, it was tiresome at the time, and it only looks worse, you know, as the years go by.
Well, I saw his latest movie this week in Brussels at the European Cinema Summit. It was very good. Away We Go. It stars John Krasinski. I was going to say I can't pronounce his name, and then I go ahead and pronounce his name. And Maya Rudolph. Maya Rudolph, of course, is probably best known for appearing on Saturday Night Live. John Krasinski is one of the leads in the American version of The Office on television. And I thought it was a very funny, very unique film. Have you, either of you seen it?
Nope.
I haven't seen it either. I'm curious about it, but it's one of those movies I'm going to wait and see what the reviews say and what my friends say before I decide to go see it. I like the premise. I think that's really interesting.
But, yeah, the premise is
it has to be done well.
The premise is Krasinski and Rudolph are a couple, and she winds up finding out she's pregnant, and they decide that, you know, given that they're about to have a child, they have to find a good place to live. And so they go and visit several different cities, visiting friends and family along the way. It's actually quite funny and in a quirky kind of way. So,
isn't it too a lot about like how he is going to deal with how he deals with the news that he's going to be a father and what I think all men go through when they find out that their partner is pregnant, like pure panic?
Peter Panic?
Pure panic.
Panic.
Oh, I thought, although Peter Panic wouldn't be a good
they all turned into Peter Panic.
No, actually he seems to be quite fine with it. That was actually maybe the one thing that wasn't true to life, which is, you know, he can't wait to be a father.
But Sam, I'm glad to hear this movie might be good, because I think Sam Mendes is a great theater director, and anyone in London should go check out A Winter's Tale, which is at the Old Vic. It's one of the best productions of Shakespeare I've ever seen in my life. But his movies have mostly left me cold. Revolutionary Road, Jarhead, Road to Perdition, American Beauty. They're all competent, but none of them excite me very much.
Yeah, that's true. There's something kind of cold about them.
What are the movies in the deal that he's does he have any movies announced in the deal that he's working on?
One is a novel by John Williams called Butcher's Crossing, and Variety says it's about a man who heads to the American Midwest to participate in one of the last great buffalo hunts of the 1870s. And then, Michael, you might be interested in his second film. He beat out Martin Scorsese, who wanted to direct the film. It is based on a George Eliot novel, Middlemarch, the 800-page novel.
It's a great, great novel. It's literally one of my favorite books, but I don't want Sam Mendes to direct it. And actually, John Williams, is that John Edward Williams, do you know?
Well, it's a 1960s. Now, this is talking about Butcher's Crossing, which is a 1960 John Williams novel.
Yeah. I think that's the guy who also wrote Stoner. He is a really, really good unknown author. I believe he passed away a few years ago. He won the National Book Award for Augustus about the first Caesar of Rome. And he wrote this book, Stoner, about a college professor, which is really, really a remarkably good book. And I think all three of them have been published by the New York Review of Books. They put them back out in circulation. He's starting to get some of the attention he never quite got, because even though he won the National Book Award, he never had a very high profile. And he's a terrific novelist as well. But Middlemarch is a masterpiece, and you've just told me a director I don't like is going to be filming it. So that's a bummer, because there's never been a great film production of Middlemarch.
Well, Scorsese
I can't
wanted
believe
to direct
Sam
it.
Mendes got it over Scorsese. What the hell's that about?
Yeah, that's just depressing.
Well, Andrew Davis wrote the screenplay for
Of course.
Middlemarch, and it's about the inhabitants of an 1830s English community.
It's about
Wait, Michael,
life and the
why do you
entire.
say, of course, Andrew Davis wrote it?
Oh, Andrew Davies is a major fixture in British television. I think there's a law that he must adapt every British novel for television. I mean, he's done every production you can think of in the last 15 years. He is a major, major figure in British television. He writes everything. Any British production you've seen of Dickens or Jane Austen or Trollope or apparently George Eliot, who is a woman, though I always forget that. He's the guy who has written it. His credits are as long as your arm, and he's very good. So it's just it, there is a law that he must adapt any British novel. So
Wow, what
it's
happens if you break that law?
then you get a really bad movie, I guess, because he's a very good writer and he's done very good adaptations over the years. But if you look him up on IMDb, Andrew Davies, Davies, you will find a list that goes on and on and on.
Wait, speaking about bad movies, I hear that Public Enemies is not as good as it should be.
Oh, so you must be talking about the fact that Lou Lemenick from the New York Post, the film critic for the New York Post, went to see Michael Mann's latest film, Public Enemies, starring Johnny Depp, and it's about Michael, what is this
And
movie about?
Christian Bale.
And Christian Bale. It's it,
Thank you
the
very much.
it's about the bank robber whose name is completely escaping me now.
John Dillinger.
John Dillinger, thank you.
The man with the lady in the red dress at the movie theater.
Yes. And so it's kind of a
It's a gangster pick. He's a gangster. He's got a girlfriend who's played by Marion Cotillard, who won the Oscar for the Edith Piaf biopic, and she's playing some Midwestern American for some reason, the French woman. And I don't know if you guys looked at Lou Luminick's post, but it was a little ridiculous. He said, "Oh, I saw the movie and wrote a review, and I didn't realize there was an embargo." There's an embargo for every decent-sized movie that Hollywood puts out. Every critic knows you can't just write a review of any movie whenever you want. And when it's a big summer or Christmas movie, there's always an embargo or always an implied date when you shouldn't run a review before you do. And if you want, you're not sure, you need to ask them and find out. So he's being totally disingenuous.
Huh, I had no idea. I thought if you saw a movie and you were a reviewer, you could just write about it. No?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Because they don't want to force everyone to have to see it 3 days or 2 days or one day before it comes out. So they have screenings for a couple of weeks before the movie opens. Or sometimes they let you see a movie months in advance because they want you to write a story as well as do a review. So it's every reviewer of every major newspaper knows what the rules are. They know when they go. If I went to see Transformers last week, I couldn't just run a review last week because all the other critics would be annoyed. It's usually like 3 days or 2 days before the film opening. I think the rule of thumb is if a movie opens on Friday, the review can't run before Wednesday, and so on. It works something like that. But they all know that there's an embargo. I mean, when does this movie open up? And he just posts a review online the second he sees it. That's what, Ain't It Cool News does. That's not what serious critics on major newspapers.
Yes, he says here, I have redacted much of this post at the request of Universal, which complained I violated a June 25th embargo, which I was not informed of going into last night's screening.
The irony is that he gives it a bad review, and I know that one of the studios was annoyed at the New York Daily News because they ran a review of what was it? Was it Terminator Salvation? They ran a review. They were practically the only people to give it a good review, but they were still mad at them because they ran the review early. So, everybody knows. I don't think they're gonna be able to show critics movies in advance. There's such pressure for the papers to be first that, they can't resist. They just can't resist.
Actually, Jeffrey Wells of Hollywood Elsewhere suggested that Universal should actually lift the embargo and let a few good reviews leak out to combat the fact that the story now is the fact that this bad review was pulled.
It's a terrible idea. How would you determine who's going to give it a good review? You're going to poll people and then say, okay, you can write a review now. Then you're getting into an area where you're saying, okay, you can write a review early if you like it. Well, you know, then you'd really have an uproar, because as soon as someone posts a review, everyone gets to post their review. This guy broke the rules. But if they go to the Writer Entertainment Weekly, for example, and say, did you like Public Enemies? Okay, post your review right now. Then all the papers who are following the rules and waiting until the embargo is over are going to say that's ridiculous, and then the cat's out of the bag. You can't decide who gets to run a review early. You have to give everyone the same rule. You know, run it on this date, or you'll be in trouble. You can't do it based on whether the review is good or not.
Well, I will agree with you that you can't break the rules and play favorites. That I agree with. Although the reality is, publicists know which critics liked a film, because they ask them point blank as they're walking out of the screening, or the next day when they call them and say, hey, you saw Public Enemies last night, what did you think? And
I never answer. I never tell them. What they do is they make polite blandishments. If they don't like it, they say, oh, blah, blah, blah. And then the review comes out and they give a negative review. They don't want to get into, I know a lot of critics who just sort of, they try not to say anything negative to the publicist because they don't want to deal with them. And they don't say, oh, I hated it, sucked. They just go, it was pretty good. That doesn't mean they're committed to giving it a nice review, you know.
Well, in the vein that no publicity is bad publicity, maybe this will actually wind up helping Public Enemies.
Will you go see it, Karen?
I think it's going to do fine. Yeah, I'm totally excited to see it. Unless it gets a review that it's boring. Because that's my biggest issue with going to the movies. I'm really disappointed if a movie is boring. But I can certainly enjoy a good bad movie. I think this looks good. And I like Johnny Depp, and I like Christian Bale. And unless it gets horrible reviews by everybody, yeah, I'm going to go see it.
And good old Billy Crudup is in it. He has a funny Boston accent.
Yeah, I don't like him at all. I don't like him at all. I can't get past
him. I was just going to say that.
Mary Elizabeth, whatever her name is, on Weeds. I just can't
Mary Louise Parker.
That. Yeah, he just.
Well, for those people who don't know what happened there, he was dating Mary Louise Parker. They weren't married, but I guess they were an item, and they had a child together. And then, she was
eight months pregnant,
which makes this story all the better. But
even worse.
He ran off with Claire Danes, actress Claire Danes. And yeah. So leaving her with the baby.
Yeah.
But you can't start, you know, watching movies based on actors' private lives, or you'll never watch any movie
ever.
But
for me, like, sometimes it spills over, because, like, yeah. I was always kind of mixed on Billy Crudup. I thought he was really good and Almost Famous, but I've never really enjoyed him in anything else. But when you read about him doing something like this, I personally can't get past what a complete jerk he sounds like.
We highlighted a story here that I don't know how much we want to talk about this. It's the Miramax story, that Miramax is
Weinstein.
The Weinstein company. That should tell you what Harvey Weinstein, Bob Weinstein, so associated with Miramax Films for nearly two decades, if not longer. They now ran off and started the Weinstein Co. after their divorce with Miramax.
What, 5 years ago?
I guess so. They've released a number of films under the Weinstein Company banner, except they are now having some money problems, and they are asking, according to several sources, they are asking Quentin Tarantino to edit his Inglourious Basterds, his next film, which Michael, you and I saw in Cannes, which we talked about several weeks ago. The film at the time ran about 2 hours, 30, 35 minutes, and they're asking him to cut it by about 40 minutes, and that might be because, according to several sources, they don't have enough money to release the film. The New York Times is saying that they're close to bankruptcy, and they hired a group called Miller Buckfire LLC to help manage its debt. And Miller Buckfire is actually well known for helping people file for bankruptcy, so that might be where the rumors started. And once again, Michael Siepley covered this story about 2 weeks ago. He had a really good week 2 weeks ago. But please,
when have the Weinsteins never not asked a filmmaker to cut 10, 20, 30, or 40 minutes out of their movie?
Actually,
you know, they've done it with every movie they've ever made.
No, not really. Not when it comes to Tarantino. I mean, think about it. They let him release Kill Bill in two films.
Yeah, they got two films for the price of one. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
Good point.
You're not going to
Yeah,
make
but you know.
Inglourious Basterds more commercial by cutting half an hour out of it. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, at this point, they may as well just let it stand.
But I think we may be missing the point here, which is that they hired a company that's well known for specializing in bankruptcy. I mean, I've read a lot of things about the Weinstein Company going under. I don't think they were in very good shape from the very beginning.
I think you're right. I do believe that they're having financial problems, like a lot of companies, because of the collapse of the economy. And I do believe they're asking Tarantino to cut Inglourious Basterds. I just don't think they're linked. I don't think they're saying, "Oh my God, we have to cut 30 minutes out of the film because we're running out of money." They have nothing to do with each other.
I agree. In fact, you know, I wonder if maybe they're just buying time because I believe that they probably don't have the money to distribute it, although I imagine that they could get it. But I wonder if they're just buying time because they don't have the money right now. So just like, hey, yeah, cut a half hour. Although knowing Quentin Tarantino and his movie making style, it probably needs about an hour and a half cut out.
The movie would be like 20 minutes long.
Well, good. And then finally it would be a decent Tarantino movie.
Sharon Waxman writes in The Wrap, her new blog about the business. "The Weinsteins have more lives than a pair of Siamese cats. When I crossed paths with Bob Weinstein on a plane back from Cannes, I mentioned the widespread rumors that his company was on the cusp of financial disaster." And she reports he said, "They've been saying that for years," he tossed off breezily on his way off the plane to a private car.
And part of me wonders too if it's just like gossip that people spread because they hate the Weinstein so much.
I think part of that has to be true. Michael, do you hate the Weinsteins?
No, not at all. I wouldn't want to work for them or perhaps work with them, but they've made a lot of really good movies happen, and they've, you know, supported a lot of really good directors over the years. Miramax has had a great run, and you know they've been associated with a lot of terrific movies. They must be pains in the neck to work with, but you know they're old school Hollywood producers. Life is more fun having them around, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, I say that half jokingly because, of course, journalists tend not to hate the Weinsteins because they make really decent films most of the time. But I would say that you're correct. A lot of people who work in the industry just find it very difficult to work with them.
But damn, are they exciting to write about?
Moving on, Karen, you're going to tell us about some reality show
Hal
TV
Roker
star that
yells
I
at
don't know.
Spidey, okay? Maybe. Can't believe you guys don't know who Spidey is.
I don't know who
Spencer
Spidey is.
Pratt.
Spidey to me is a
Spencer
guy
Pratt.
that slings webs through Gotham City or
Yeah, no,
through
this is not
Manhattan.
anybody wearing a suit. This is Spencer Pratt and Heidi Montag, who are best known for being the obnoxious pair from The Hills. And they were on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, which is a show that I have to say I don't watch, although I accidentally caught a marathon of it this weekend. And
How do you
they raised.
accidentally catch a marathon? You
Because.
accidentally watch 12 hours of the show?
Yeah, no, okay, you know how it's like on when you're like getting out of the shower or whatever, and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I cannot stop watching this. That's what it turned out to be. I spent like 6 hours. Okay, it was probably four, but like, yeah, watching I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I'm ashamed, okay? I'm ashamed. Unfortunately, I was so bummed because when I was the four episodes that I watched, Heidi and Spencer had already left the show.
Now,
But these two.
just to let our listeners know, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here takes a bunch of B-list celebrities, and I'm being polite by calling them that.
Yeah,
And
they're D-listers.
they're D-listers, and
Yeah.
they effectively, well, actually drop
They
them in
put
the
them in
Costa
the
Rican
jungle and they
jungle.
have to survive and they do like, little contests and stuff. But it's really just a wonderful way of watching D-listers interact with one another. But Heidi and Spencer are this, there's like this paparazzi, fodder. That's really all they're famous for being famous. They're like Paris Hilton. And so they agreed, though, to be on this show. And then by the first episode, they were like, we are way too famous for this show. We're going to leave. It's like,
Which they actually
okay,
said.
no. Yeah, no, they really said that. And obviously nobody liked them because they're totally obnoxious. And then, so they left and then they decided to come back. And Heidi blamed the whole thing on the devil. So, the devil had taken her over. And then she faked being sick. So they eventually had to leave. And they were so obnoxious on the show. And they're clearly just such awful people. But they were interviewed by Al Roker on the Today Show, which in itself is ironic because if they're so famous that there can't be, on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, why are they allowing the weatherman to interview them? But
Now, Al Roker,
so
for
Al
listeners who don't know, who might be out of the country,
Al Roker's the weatherman on the Today Show. So Al is interviewing them, and to his credit, it's a pretty good interview. And he says to them, are you proud of your behavior? And they keep kind of skirting around it, being like, well, it's tough being a celebrity, and times are tough, or they're just talking around it. And Al keeps coming back to the question, but are you proud? She's like, well, I'm not ashamed. He's like, so you're proud. He just kept coming, hammering home. I'm like, go Al, go the weatherman. And it was a good interview because he wasn't, he didn't pull any punches. He was just like, are you proud? So you're proud of your behavior. And he clearly just despised them. He treated them with such disdain. It was so awesome.
Yeah, there was disdain
It was
dripping off of
vaguely
him.
unprofessional, which is why it was so cool to have like the weatherman interview
Well,
them.
and in the end, it kind of ends in a fairly funny way. He, the I don't know, Spencer, I guess, was saying, "Well, I don't know what I'm going to do in life next. I might go over there," and he points off camera,
Oh,
or
he points off stage. I might go over there.
yeah, and Al Roker says, "Yeah, you're going to go over there because this interview's over."
So clever, I know, right? Oh, yeah, they ought to make him interview more people. Did you guys see the David Letterman where he actually insulted Sarah Palin's kid?
But I've seen all the clips of it since then. But it's ridiculous. He obviously never met the 14-year-old daughter. He was referring to the daughter who had already had sex out of wedlock and given birth
He's
to a
talking about
child.
Bristol.
Yeah, but he wasn't. He was just referring to her. He wasn't. If you watch the original joke, which was pretty lame, it was clear. Clearly, he was not thinking of the 14-year-old child. Frankly, I didn't even realize he had another child, and I'm sure he maybe didn't either. And as soon as they said, "Oh, what a terrible joke," he apologized profusely, and they have just kept adding fuel to the fire to try and get attention for themselves, and it's ridiculous.
Now
I mean,
the
he
they in this
apologized.
case being now David Letterman is a late night talk show host. He made a joke about Sarah Palin, a former vice presidential candidate with John McCain, and current I guess he's currently a
Who do you think is listening to the
I have no
podcast
idea.
that
Yeah,
you
who
have
does
to
not know who
explain
Letterman
who
and Sarah
David Letterman and
Palin
Sarah Palin
is?
are? Are you sending this out into space, hoping
I don't know, I'm just trying to
that
cover my bases.
Well, you should probably just say exactly what happened.
Well,
And
Sarah Palin came to New
actually,
York.
Michael, you probably know better because you saw it. But from what my understanding, it was like part of a top 10 list or something, and something about Alice Rodriguez like knocking up Sarah Palin's daughter. And Sarah Palin, I think was she there with
No,
Willow?
she Sarah Palin has two
Two different
daughters.
cities.
One's name is Willow and she's 14. One's
No, she's got three. She's got Bristol, who was the one that was knocked up. She's got Willow, who's the 14-year-old, and she's got Piper, who's the cute little 9-year-old, the one who was always, holding the retarded kid.
Well, she went to New York with Willow, the 14-year-old, and David Letterman made a joke that basically ran along the lines of, now watch me butcher this thing. Sarah Palin was in New York over the weekend. They went to a Yankee game. It was quite awkward. By the seventh inning stretch, Alex Rodriguez had knocked up her daughter, not realizing that the daughter she was in town with
Where's the 14-year-old?
was the 14-year-old. And the Republicans and Sarah Palin and her husband basically have harped on this and latched onto this and turned it into something way bigger than it should have been by lambasting Letterman for making an improper joke about a 14-year-old. And
Okay, now
he
I'm just going to say something here, and I hate Sarah Palin with a passion. But she made a point on the Today Show, you guys know what I watch in the morning, saying something along the lines of, that how are we supposed to teach our daughters to respect themselves if late night comics make jokes like this?
Give
And
me a
I kind
break.
of, no, I kind of saw her point.
No.
Like, I
David
think that it's
Letterman.
important. No, you have to explain to the daughter it was a joke, and she has to understand as a public figure that kind of stuff happens. But it's really not that funny to say that a public figure's daughter got knocked up. I do
Was not
find that actually
referring to the
offensive.
14-year-old. He was not
It doesn't
referring to her.
matter.
He,
Doesn't matter.
a woman who has had sex out of wedlock, and Sarah Palin parades around the country proudly, brings her boyfriend on stage to the Republican National Convention and says, "What a great kid this is. This kid who knocked up my daughter out of wedlock, treats him like a celebrity and a hero and a member of the family, but then once she loses the election, throws him aside and won't let him see their child." The
Oh, I
idea
don't
that this
disagree with you.
woman, well, yes, but this Letterman, as soon as it was pointed out to him that this was the 14-year-old daughter, he apologized profusely and repeatedly
No,
on the
I
air.
agree. I'm completely on Letterman's side with
Letterman. And if you watch Letterman, you know he doesn't make lots of ribald jokes. It's not his thing. It's not what he does. We're not talking Howard Stern here. And he apologized genuinely and profusely and invited them to be on the show. And they have just kept acting like they're still offended when it was a dumb joke. He apologized for it and shouldn't have made it. But he doesn't go around denigrating 14-year-old girls or joking about them being raped. That's ridiculous.
No, I totally agree. I totally agree with you. I'm on Letterman's side with this 150%, and I think that Sarah Palin is a horrible person. But I do think that there are a lot of jokes like that that are made that are misogynistic that do affect the way that girls feel about themselves. I thought that that point was good. I don't think she meant it as deep as I'm saying it, but I thought that she could have.
But Letterman is not the source of that problem.
Well, you know, he also never apologizes.
But Letterman did apologize. He apologized regularly.
No, and she mishandled it for sure. But I agree with you 100%, except for the one point that she made, and she didn't put it, you know, very eloquently, but her point was that there are misogynist jokes that comedians make that everybody else lets them get away with. And I'm not saying Letterman did it, but there are comedians out there who do it. And I do think it has to affect women and how they feel about themselves. As a woman, that's what I think.
The lame part of this actual story, the reason we're talking about it, because it's been going on for a week or so, is that the Embassy Suites hotel chain pulled an ad from the CBS website.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
This is the example of their big
boycott. They're not getting 35 cents this week?
Exactly. This is the lamest to mention this means your boycott has not worked. People have accepted Letterman's apology. They know he's not known for ribald and denigrating jokes. And the show is doing great in the ratings. And Sarah Palin is again, you know, trying to ride her daughter, you know, an insult that she saw to her daughter for publicity purposes.
I totally agree with you. I do. I totally agree with you.
That actually brings us to our next story about Texas Instruments announcing this week. And I'm actually quite proud of this story because it appeared on Celluloid Junkie, which is a blog that covers the motion picture exhibition and distribution industry. So it's kind of an insidery type blog. It's a very inside baseball blog. But it's a blog that I helped start. And Carolyn Giardina wrote a story about Texas Instruments moving to a 4K technology rather than a 2K technology to compete with Sony. And just a little background here. Motion picture theaters are moving away from 35mm film towards digital cinema. And what digital cinema is showing a film using a digital projector rather than a film projector. And so no actual film or 35mm film is required. So the film arrives either via satellite or on a hard drive. It's a huge file. It's about 150, 200 gigabytes. But to differentiate what you see at home on your high-definition television sets from what you see in the theater, the movie studios got together and said that you have to have a resolution, the picture has to have a resolution that is greater than 1080p, than what you could get at home. So they went to JPEG 2000, which is a file format that is 2,000 or 2 million pixels across, effectively. It's a very high resolution. It's higher than high-def. Now, what some people are saying is film in and of itself is 6K. So it's basically JPEG 6000, if you will. And so what Sony Electronics has done, not Sony the movie studio, they have created a technology that is 4000. It's JPEG 4000. It's 4K. They wound up landing two very large theater chains, AMC Cinemas and Regal Entertainment. And so Christie and Barco, who use Texas Instruments' DLP chip, which are in many of the television sets, many high-definition television sets, they were a little worried and concerned, as was Texas Instruments, who makes its money by licensing that technology, because they didn't have 4K technology, and it seemed 4K was going to be the wave of the future, as everybody knew at some point it would be. So, sure enough, this week, Carolyn Giardina published a story mentioning that Texas Instruments was rumored to be going toward a 4K technology and was going to announce it shortly, prompting Texas Instruments to not only announce that it would be doing so, but prompting Christie and Barco, the two projector manufacturers, to mention when they would be releasing the new 4K projectors. and also prompting Barco to announce that they had cut a deal with Cinemark, the third largest chain in America, to install Barco digital cinema projectors exclusively throughout the circuit. So this is all, again, very inside baseball, but it is huge news for these particular industries because it, in many people's opinion, will stop the rollout of digital cinema, the very technology that actually helps bring us 3D movies.
Why will it stop it?
A lot of the exhibitors, a lot of the movie theater chains have always felt, well, the technology isn't set yet, so I'm not going to buy equipment. Because movie theaters are notoriously cheap when it comes to equipment. They'll buy a film projector and then not replace it for 50 years, literally 50 years. So they're reticent to put $100,000 into equipment that's only going to last 10 or 15 tops. And so they want to wait until the technology is set. Well, it seems like the studios getting together and forming the Digital Cinema Initiative and kind of setting up the standards or the requirements for digital cinema helped. But now the question is this really going to be the end, or am I going to buy this technology and then find out you're moving to 4K or 8K or 12K or whatever the next technology is going to be? So a lot of people have been concerned about, should I go with 2K or should I wait for a higher resolution? Well, now this just confirms that they should wait for the higher resolution.
And what does it mean for moviegoers? How soon will 4K be hitting actual theaters and they'll be able to see that much of a better picture? And will theaters be advertising we have 4K the way they do when they say we have IMAX or we have 3D? Will they be? Will it be a way to differentiate themselves, you know, like THX was for a while?
Yes, and actually, I don't know that you'll be able to charge for 4K extra the way you do for a 3D film, because 3D does actually cost more because of the glasses, because of the technology that is required to run a 3D film. But I do think that they will be advertising it, and I know that in some cases they actually do. At the Landmark in Los Angeles, you know, Sony has its little, you know, this is a 4K CineAlta Sony cinema, you know, so it will be like THX. Whereas 2K, like, everybody's got 2K. It's, you know, just a little better than high def. Now, mind you, just to give you some sense of, this can get really technical here, so I'm going to try to avoid that. There are very few seats in a movie theater that actually can benefit from 4K. So it depends on where you sit in a movie theater as to whether 4K matters.
Yeah, you got to be dead center. Like on a THX, I mean on an IMAX, you really got to be, you want to be centered, especially if it's a movie adapted to IMAX.
You know, you want to be if you're on the outside.
Well, if you're on the outside and you're close, it will still actually, if you're really close, it will still matter. If you're on the side in the last row, it's not going to matter at all. If you're dead center in the last row, it could matter depending on the size of the auditorium. I mean, again, it could get really scientific.
And you're saying that 35 millimeter is 6K?
6K, yes.
So you're saying we're spending all this money and technology to try to get something that's still like 50% less good than film, which we've had for 80 years.
Well, film is 6K when it's captured. But then after they make an inner negative and duplicate it, who knows if it's still 6K. I mean, obviously the film that's being projected is still 6K, but the resolution has been brought down significantly.
For people sitting in the audience, you'll see a big difference.
It is the difference between listening to a scratched record and listening to a CD. And that's the way it's been described recently, is that
In other words, the movies we're seeing now are scratched records?
Well, they are after 4 weeks of having them run through a film projector. You can really begin to notice the scratches and the pops and the hisses and things like that. Whereas when you see a digital film, it is pristine. There is not a scratch on it. It either plays or it doesn't. Really, the reason that people are moving towards digital cinema is for movie theaters, it's flexibility. And for distributors, it's to decrease the cost of distributing a film. It's allowed for alternative content. It allows for... I was at a movie theater outside of Amsterdam, an hour outside of Amsterdam. I don't know how many screens it had. It seemed like it had like 10 or more. But they don't actually assign a film to a theater. You wait in the lobby and you watch a board as if you were in a train station waiting to find out what auditorium your film is going to be in based on how many people purchase tickets.
That's hilarious.
That makes sense.
And that's what digital cinema can allow. So, and that's why some movie theater owners want to move towards it, because it provides way more flexibility. And, of course, distributors love the fact that they don't have to strike 4,000 prints.
My local theater shows different stuff, like Glenn Beck doing a promotional concert for his new book. Is that the, you know, people go in and can see anything. They can see a live concert. They can see, you know, during on Easter, they had a concert from England of the Messiah. And in the next week or so, Glenn Beck is doing some satellite digital, you know, tour reading of his new book. So theaters get filled up with all sorts of junk during the day.
Actually, I don't think that's all necessarily junk. I think some of that's actually kind of cool.
Have you ever gone to one? I don't know anyone who's ever done any of those things.
No.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to tell you this, Michael. It's actually quite popular. So popular, in fact, and this is alternative content that we're talking about. It's so popular that the New York Metropolitan Opera series, which by far is the most successful alternative content series that's been around for a while, they are showing it all over the world. In fact, at this movie theater yesterday, they had posters for it all over the place, and it's brought up at every cinema exhibition conference I go to. And of course, I work in that field that's my day job, and so I'm here in Amsterdam to attend Cinema Expo. But it will be brought up there as well. As a matter of fact, they're going to show 3D opera in 3D.
What sort of numbers do they do?
You know what? I don't want to quote figures because I could be wrong about that. But they're making a lot of money. If they weren't making a lot of money, they wouldn't be broadcasting it all over the world, and movie theater owners wouldn't be talking about it the way they are.
Yeah, but the movie theater owners are the ones who are screwed by this deal you're talking about, right? Hollywood kept telling them, you have to buy these new projectors, you have to buy these new projectors. And now they're finally, more and more theaters have digital projection, and now they've just found out their projectors are outdated and they have to go up to 4K.
Well, they don't have to go up to 4K because 2K really is good enough. You would hardly be able to tell the difference between 2K and 4K. The average viewer, the everyday moviegoer, would never be able to tell the difference.
Why bother? If nobody can tell the difference, if the layperson can't tell the difference, why bother?
Yeah, unless you sit in one seat, which is marked specially.
Yeah.
Because of fear. The movie theater owner who is thinking about buying 2K fears that the movie theater owner down the street is going to get 4K and then advertise it.
No, really, to me, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But I mean,
yeah, what's the fear? I might be scared of
buying that. But yeah, as a moviegoer, seems like an awful lot of wasted money to me.
Well, also for fear of obsolete, you know, for fear of becoming, you know, purchasing an obsolete technology.
Well, that's my point.
Yeah, they're buying the HD DVD, or they're going for Blu-ray, and the audience is saying, "Who cares? I'm not paying extra money for Blu-ray, so why are you bothering?" And the format's flopping. If they normally advertise 4K, and if most viewers won't know the difference, and if you have to take 10 minutes to explain to me how, if I'm sitting in the second row on the third seat, I might see a better picture, my eyes are rolling back, and I don't give a damn anymore.
Yeah, and frankly, I'm not noticing all the hisses and pops about, you know, regular movies going through the projector.
Digital is definitely a big improvement over 35 millimeter as far as being able to see a good print of the movie you want to see, seeing a good image. That's definitely true. I've been to many theaters where I've seen scratchy prints or a hair in the projector. So digital is definitely a jump over 35 millimeter as far as the presentation in theaters around the country. And we all understand IMAX, but when you're saying 4K digital versus 2K digital, it doesn't sound like much of it. It sounds like a waste of time.
Time will tell whether the industry stops rolling out digital cinema. Certainly, we'll know when Avatar opens, James Cameron's film, and if people stop purchasing their digital cinema projectors, they won't be able to show that film in 3D, which is how it was shot and how it was meant to be shown. And so James Cameron...
Yeah, but I have to say, I bet only a handful of people really care about seeing it in 3D.
Actually,
Yeah, Karen, I think your antipathy for cartoons, animated films, is what's maybe having you miss the boat a little bit, because people pay extra $5 to see animated films in 3D every day. People pay up a lot more money to see Polar Express in 3D, Up in 3D. They'll pay extra to see Ice Age in 3D. So, I mean, people are definitely spending the money and showing they're willing to spend top dollar to see 3D films. It's happening all the time.
I think that people will go and see this because it's a James Cameron film. I don't think they necessarily, except the diehards, necessarily care that it's in 3D.
Well, you're absolutely right. And everyone will go see it because it's his first movie since Titanic. But he's pulling people along into 3D. I mean, they're going to see it because it's James Cameron, and he's saying, oh, my God, I'm going to blow you away with this new technology.
And I can tell you from working inside the motion picture exhibition and distribution space that everybody is looking forward to this film in terms of preparing their cinemas for 3D specifically for this film. It really has – this one film has helped roll out this technology. Now, other films have too, but this film more than others. Anyway, I know that this is way more than we wanted to, way more time than we wanted to spend on this topic, but I was quite proud that Carolyn wound up breaking this story. You know, it was quite nice to see that a blog really can affect this industry.
Yeah.
Now speaking of which,
a podcast can do it too.
Good point. Another blog that affected the industry, it seems, is Nikki Fink's blog. Go figure. Or at least this is according to her. She reported that very early on Friday that John Lesher, the head of Paramount Pictures Film Group, would be leaving Paramount or be asked to leave Paramount. And then eventually she heard that Brad Weston, I guess the second in command there, would also be asked to leave, and that Adam Goodman would be put in charge. Adam Goodman, another executive at Paramount who used to be with DreamWorks and who used to go to NYU Film School with myself, actually. I remember.
No way. Do you know him?
He was a class. Yeah, from like, you know, 15, 16 years ago. And then, of course, when he worked at DreamWorks and we were at the agencies, when I was at CAA and you were, I guess, still at William Morris, I knew him then. But he was an assistant then, and then he was a, you know, a creative exec, and of course now he's running one of Hollywood's biggest studios.
Has he been behind quality? Are we happy that this guy's being in charge of Paramount?
Well, he was behind Transformers, I Love You Man, Hotel for Dogs, which, you know, one of the best dog movies ever made.
Norbit. I'm gonna say that's a yes. He deserves this.
Blades of Glory, Disturbia, Tropic Thunder, and Eagle Eye, to name just a few.
So, but what happened to John Lesher?
Well, according to Nikki Fink, since, you know, she broke this story, and because she broke it, they had to lay off or let go John Lesher a few weeks early. They hadn't planned on doing it just now.
You don't think he knew?
According to her, it had been floated around the Paramount lot for some time, but they hadn't planned on making any announcements for a couple of weeks, but then her story came out, and so she, you know, they had to make a decision right away. She says, Lesher drew notice for looking, quote, whacked and blank-faced and falling down drunk, and I'll let you fill in that blank, during the studio's big Benjamin Buttons and Sweeney Todd screening parties. He's known to nod off in front of directors during their discussions. He's been seen dozing on his office couch in the afternoons. That may be because he's been up to 3 a.m., often making, quote, incoherent and rambling and emotional, end quote, communications with his Paramount colleagues. For instance, Lesher's bizarre wee hour emails to Adam Goodman are now the stuff of legend. So,
wait, what is he drunk dialing? I mean, what are these rambling and emotional communications?
I don't know. Apparently, they're the stuff of legend, though.
Apparently, I've been behaving like a Hollywood executive all these years.
I was a Hollywood executive in college.
Just without the email.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, brother.
You know, I always love me a good ouster story, I have to say. John Lesher was at Paramount Vantage for a while, and he was kind of getting a bad reputation there as well. So it doesn't really surprise me, but I imagine he'll land somewhere really great, like, you know, the Weinstein Company.
Yeah. Well, of course, he has a studio deal now. He's going to move to a producing deal, as will Brad Weston.
Really?
Yeah, there's a shock.
Yeah. I give him, you know, a couple of years.
I would love for somebody to do a story on how many films have come out of these former head of studio turned into producer production deals. I would like to know what the benefits are of that. Not to say that they shouldn't become producers, because certainly these studio heads, they know the industry and they can get just about anybody on the phone. But I wonder if they are at all profitable.
It's just a gold watch. It's just a parting gift.
I agree. There are very few studio heads that make good producers. I think it's a different skill set. A studio head and an executive, they're pretty much their job is to say no. When you're a producer, your job is to push things through and get the yes. So you could argue they understand that, you know, the what has to happen, but they don't necessarily have the same frame of mind that requires to do it.
Brad Gray said here in the press release that was released really late on Friday. So maybe Nikki Fink is correct in saying that she helped push this a little bit. He is quoted as saying, "Adam has proven himself to be a terrific executive with a track record of having shepherded some incredibly successful films." And he goes on to say, "We have worked closely with Adam over the last few years and look forward to expanding his duties." Officially now, Paramount is calling this shape up a streamlining.
Okay.
Okay, two people does not a streamlining make.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this to me, I call this a promotion and a firing, but okay. Streamlining.
Oh, brother. Well, how many times can I say, oh, brother, in one?
You've been pretty good in this podcast, not so many times.
Well, certainly, I appreciate that Michael has been able to join us because it's midnight. Well, it was midnight when we started this podcast. It's probably like 5 in the morning now.
It's midnight my time now, actually. Everybody wish me a happy birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, Karen.
Happy
That's right.
birthday.
Thank you.
We will
That's
all sing
exciting.
happy birthday to Karen now and then
No, don't do
ask her
that.
how old she
Don't
is.
do that. But Michael, we love it when you play with us. It's always fun to have a third person.
Well, thanks for having me on.
If you are looking for links to any of the stories we discussed in today's episode, you can find them in the show notes, which is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can email us, as we said at the opening of the episode, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can give us a call as well and leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567 SAND or 888-567-7263. We will review all of the emails each week and read a few of them during a future episode. We'll also do the same with voicemails. We'll play a few during a future episode. You can visit our website to find out all of our social networking sites, from Twitter to Facebook to LinkedIn. We're on all of them. Karen, anything else to add? Michael?
You have covered it.
I say, don't denigrate women and show your support for smart women by not supporting Sarah Palin.
I agree.
Don't be a misogynist.
Don't be a misogynist. And you can find my stuff at michaelgiltz.com, GILTZ, or find links to my latest stories at my blog, popsurfing.com, PopSurfing.
Michael, I'm so sorry. I usually start with that, and usually I don't have to be reminded to remind you to plug your various.
Not at all.
Have you joined
Well, that's
Twitter yet?
family member now, so we forget.
No, I
You
don't twit.
don't. Yeah, you know. Look, Twitter is saving Iran, and yet we still can't convince some people they should be on.
I'm wearing green right now. I'm just not tweeting.
Well, thank you all very much. Until next week, play nice.